It's nice to follow in the footsteps of an overgrown freak, isn't it? It's, thank you, Jamie. It's really good to be with you. I can proudly announce that today the town where I live features in the Daily Telegraph. Yes, absolutely, it's very good. So I live in a place called Horsforth, and if you read your Daily Telegraph very, very carefully today, you'll see that there is a fox, apparently, in Horsforth that's been somehow obtaining a lady's leather shoe, a different one every day, and depositing it outside a woman's front door. And she's now got such a collection of women's shoes, she's put a table in her garden and said, "Don't know where these are coming from, please take it if it belongs to you." There you are, that's in the Daily Telegraph. So we're really headline-hitting people. It's great to be here. I'm going to interview Carney in just a moment. We'll go on a bit beyond 9:15. It was a nice optimistic thought, but I promise I'll finish before midnight, okay? And it's nice to see so many young people. I feel so much at home, so it's great to see you guys. Let me just read a few verses of the Bible. You'll see that this is, I suppose in many ways, the theme of Carney's story, and I'll look at these as well a little bit later on. Sometimes we hear these words read at Christmas, but anyway, the very beginning of John's Gospel, this is what we read. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him nothing was made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. This man came for a witness, to bear witness of the light, that all through him might believe. He was not that light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which gives light to every man who comes into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made by him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." Well, on that note, let me introduce to you Carney. I can't see her. She's over there. Let's give her a rapturous round of applause. Here. Carney, just a moment. Look at that. Not many people I can do that to. So it's great to have you, Carney. This is your church, isn't it? I think you're the first of the people we've interviewed actually belongs to this church. So this is where you come. You live in Maidenhead?
I do, yes. I live just down the road from here.
And where do you work?
I work at the BBC as a journalist. I'm a producer and an occasional presenter. Oh, sorry. I know this is bad news for the mic, so...
I'll tell you what, do you mind if we just take this and put it on this side, and then when you look this way, I'm just going to adjust it a little bit. There we are. So you work for the BBC as a producer?
Yes, I do.
Well, do you have to be fairly bossy to be a producer?
Sometimes when you're called to edit a programme, so, and I have a problem with bossiness, not because I'm a nice person, but because I don't know how to boss people around, because I was the youngest at home, so I got lots of bossing done to
me. Right, okay, I was the youngest too, so there we are. Now, home for you, where were you brought up?
I was brought up in South Africa on the East Coast in a place called Durban, and that's in the province of KwaZulu-Natal. And there's quite a few South Africans here, so they probably know exactly what I'm talking about.
And how old were you when you came here?
Oh, do I have to?
Oh, no, okay. So no,
joking.
No,
I do.
Tell us how long ago it was since you came here.
So it was in 1996. I don't mind saying. I was 26 when I came here, in 1996.
But answer that second question again. How long ago was it since you came here? No, you don't need to. There we are. So for the first 26 years of your life, you're in South Africa, and we're well aware that South Africa some years ago really was full of political turmoil. Were you conscious of that?
Completely conscious of it. Right from the time I was six, I remember thinking that I was born the wrong colour because I had this conversation with my mum. And I'd asked her, you know, where did you get me from? And she said, well, we went to the hospital and, you know, we were looking for a baby and we saw you and we really liked you. So we picked you up and we took you home. And I was like thinking about it and I thought, oh, that's just not very nice, because if a white lady picked me up, I would have been a white baby. So.
Right. Do you know, I never knew that's how babies arrive, because we got four. I don't remember doing that. But anyway, there we are. All right. So, you were conscious of your colour.
Absolutely.
From what sort of age?
I would say from around six, because that's when my dad used to take us to the beachfront in Durban, where the entertainment area was for whites only. And I used to see just white children in the swimming pools or on the rides, and we used to be behind the fence, and my joy at the time was watching these white children have fun, and I used to get a thrill out of it because I knew I wasn't allowed, but just seeing white children in that privileged position made me think, I wish my mum hadn't picked me up, basically.
Amazing. Now, we know the word apartheid, and clearly it had implications for you, but as you grew up, they must have been more severe, were they?
It did, absolutely. I mean, the thing with apartheid was that it was a separation of people according to races. So you had the very privileged white race, and then you had Indian South Africans, is what my background is. And then you had coloured South Africans, which was mixed race. And then you had the black African people. But it was divided between the black people and the non-white. So, the black people and the white people. And under apartheid, I was classified as a black person. Hmm. Which confused people when I said, I'm black. And they said, but you're not, you're Indian. And I'm like, no, I'm black. Because that's what I knew my whole life, that I was black. And it was severe because we used to go to, for example, a restaurant when I was a child. And I remember my aunt going in and getting a hamburger, for example, from the side of the store. And I used to wonder, why weren't we allowed inside? But then I could read, and it said whites only, and I was like, oh, okay. So you had to take your cold hamburger and walk a long distance, because the bench outside, you know, the shops were whites only. Wherever you went, you saw whites only. So we had to walk miles before we could actually enjoy our lunch. Mm. That was one example. The other one was not being allowed in entertainment areas, or not being allowed in cinemas, or sitting in a different part of a cinema to other people because of the color of your skin.
And school?
School was segregated. So because I was black Indian, I went to an Indian school, which was based on a British education. So schools were separated. We lived in separate areas. And it's fascinating because I met Tanya, who grew up in the same town as I did. We lived in the same town. So we would have passed each other, but there would have been no contact because she was white and I was not.
Hmm. Now, it's one thing to watch children playing, you know, in the sea, them being white, and you just enjoy it when you're a little girl. But eventually, teenage years come and you begin to think things through. And did you become, I don't know, a political agitator in any way? Were you more than just compliant with what you were seeing?
I became a political activist and joined the ANC Youth League. And I used to wear my Nelson Mandela T-shirt really proudly. At that point, I knew that I absolutely hated white people.
Really? When you say, what age was this?
So this was around 16, where I was convinced that every white person that I would meet would be someone who would be nasty or horrible, because that was our experience. As a girl guide, when I was in, I think I was 12 when I was a girl guide, and we went to a camp in South Africa, and it was my friend and I, we were the only Indians on the trip, and there were six white children, and they wouldn't sleep anywhere next to us because we were Indian. So you were rejected because of the color of your skin. They were out of 2,000 white people, you'd find maybe half of that were nice to you at the time. That was the reality then. So there wasn't any, you know, any space to think that you could actually formulate a relationship with someone who wasn't being nice to you.
Now, just exploring a little bit about your home, religion-wise, how were you brought up?
I grew up in a Hindu home, and it was very open. We weren't staunch Hindus, but Hindus are very interesting because they believe that there is a God, so that's a great starting point. because your parents tell you that there's a God. We had something called a God lamp in our house, which we would light on a daily basis, and you'd sort of, you know, put your hands together and pray, not to it, but use it as a focal point for prayer. And my mom and dad were just very loving. You know, we were surrounded by Hindu family and friends. The only Christian in the family at the time was my uncle Michael, who was married to my father's sister.
So you did meet Christians. And what did your parents say about your uncle?
My dad just did not like him in the beginning because he married his sister and did not like him because he was Christian. And the reason as to why my dad didn't like Christians was because I grew up in a country that said that they were Christian, but were oppressive towards us. And the fact, if Indians or non-whites became Christians, they were seen as sellouts in a way, that you were joining, you were becoming part of this ridiculous institution that discriminated against non-white people. So my dad despised Christians. And then that sort of leaked, you know, sort of fed into all our state of mind. And I'd go to my uncle's house for Christmas, and I loved Christmas. I loved the presents and things. And sometimes when they used to pray us to go, that's just really silly to go on and on in prayer, and it's just so boring. And, you know, what can God do? You're asking him for so many things. Why don't you stop? And once I started laughing because it was so fervent, the prayer, that I just, you know, I started giggling in that. And I had to pretend to start crying because it was someone older who was praying, and I was embarrassed. I just started pretending that I was crying. It was awful. I was anti-Christian. So,
Now, at what stage in life did you sort of think, I'd like to be a journalist?
I knew that at a really young age because I tend to talk a lot. You'll have to stop.
Really, I just hadn't noticed that.
And I had to struggle to talk, so I enjoyed talking when I was given the privilege to. So I knew I wanted to be a journalist when I was 18, but my dad said to me, as a journalist in South Africa, where would that take you? Because every career was determined by the color of your skin. So I couldn't be a journalist, I couldn't be an actress, because there were no opportunities for you. So I did a drama degree and became a teacher in South Africa, because you could become a teacher or a doctor or a lawyer, but I wasn't clever enough.
So what led you to come over to the UK?
So in 1994, when apartheid ended, I think that's when we were, you know, we became a little bit more privileged. You could get a passport very quickly.
Was there a radical transformation in society, or was it more gradual?
No, it was very gradual. Yeah. It's still very gradual. When you go back, it's still very, you know, it still sometimes feels, some places feel very much like the past, but So in 1996, I thought, oh, I'm just going to backpack around the world. I heard all these South Africans, again, European South Africans, were going backpacking, and I thought, oh, I could do that. So I was quite bold in thinking then, you know, I could do that.
And the UK?
The UK was a start. So I started off in Israel, actually, and I was an au pair there for a little while. And so I had a round trip ticket. I started off in Israel, and then I came to London, and it would be Israel again and South Africa. I just loved Israel, but it was weird. I identified with places that my uncle had spoken about in the Bible. You know, it was beautiful, but I didn't appreciate it. Now going back would be completely
okay.
Different.
So when you came to the UK, what was your impression? I don't know what you'd imagined the UK to be like, but what did you feel it was like when you arrived?
I thought people were very very cold, because South Africans are warmer
Did you only come to the south of England?
I did.
Okay. So I understand.
I thought people were very unfriendly, because in South Africa, when you go, the reception is immediately warm and very friendly. And, you know, and then I missed South Africans, even white South Africans. It was quite strange.
Have you got the impression that perhaps England was much more of a Christian country?
Absolutely not. And that was missing, because, and again, I wrote this in my testimony, in England, in South Africa, with all its problems and confusion about race, it was spiritually more attractive, because even though they were racist, they were still God. Here, there's, you know, people are friendly and they're following rules of the UN treaties and the Geneva Convention, but people were just so, you know, God was missing. You couldn't talk about God. It was weird to be. It still is. For me, it's very hard to be a BBC journalist and declare that you...
Well, I'll come on to that eventually. So, all right, so were your expectations a little bit deflated, really, because of this sort of secularism that there is?
It was, and I think for me, I thought, well, it's very confusing now, because I thought South Africans are friendly. They're racist, but they're friendly. So I actually miss that. But I'm here in a country that's not racist because they, you know, they're following UN treaties and they're told that it's wrong, but they're not friendly. So I actually want to go back to a racist, friendly country.
All right. So now, you're a Hindu in England. Where did you start to come across Christian things again? Clearly you'd had some sort of knowledge from your uncle, but here, where did you start to...
This is really interesting because I was thinking, you know, there's this void. So Jehovah's Witnesses came along knocking on my door like they normally do. And I would invite anybody in. Anyone talking about faith, I was happy to listen to, because there was this thirst again to find out, you know, whether there was a God. So I'd invite them in and have cups of tea with them. And they attempted a Bible study, which I found terribly boring and made an excuse not to do it. And this was in the early, I think it was in 1998. And then they persevered, like they do. And then I was sitting in the lounge when 9/11 happened, and they, you know, they go to Revelation a lot. They were like, look, we told you the world's coming to an end. And I was like, oh, they must be right. They must be right. So I just, my appetite grew, because I thought, there's evidence. 9/11 happening. Jehovah's Witnesses are telling me the world's coming to an end. It's, you know, it's frightening me a little bit. So I would, you know, probably do another Bible study with them.
So did you meet with them regularly?
Yeah, for 10 years they'd come over. They'd always, you know, they were very persistent. We became friends, really good friends, actually. Beryl and Carol were the two people that came along. They became family friends, but it sort of frightened my husband a little bit and my friend Marianne. You know, they were like, oh, I would challenge Marianne sometimes about the Trinity, or she would talk to me. I wasn't quite sure still whether I was going to become a Christian or a Jehovah's Witness. I didn't like the fact that it was only through Jesus that you went to God. It wasn't appealing.
Right, okay. So this is quite a turbulent life you're living. You've got battles with racism.
Tell me about it.
Okay. And then not particularly feeling welcome in the UK. And then these, you know, we would call the Jehovah's Witnesses a sort of cults, but you were nevertheless befriending them, etc. So what eventually started you to sort of tilt you in the other direction to sort of orthodox, ordinary Christian faith?
It wasn't immediate. It just didn't happen like that. I remember having a conversation with my husband once, and he said, Kani, you know, if you become a Jehovah's Witness, it's going to be really difficult, because that means I just won't. But if you're an Anglican or something, then maybe I'll come to church. And I thought, oh, okay. But, you know, and then the Jehovah's Witnesses said, well, you know, if you come to the Kingdom Hall, your husband eventually comes along. They always do. And I thought, oh, maybe I'll just stick to Jehovah's Witnesses. But it wasn't. It was a 10-year period of not being sure. And my questions to them was like, why, you know, the 144,000 that's going to heaven.
That's what they say, yes.
Yeah. Are there any black people in it? Because that's really important to me. And they were like, oh, yes, there are a multitude of faiths. So, yes, there are people from every tribe and every language. So, okay, then that ticks one of the boxes. And Jesus, was he blonde? Did he have blue eyes? And they were like, no, he wouldn't have been, you know, he would have been only just slightly lighter than you. I was like, okay, that ticks the next box. So they were drawing me into their religion, and that became really attractive. But, you know, it was frightening to my husband and to Marianne. I'd say to Marianne, you know, the Jehovah's Witnesses are not racist. And she'd go, well, I knew racist Jehovah's Witnesses in South Africa. And I said, did you? So I became, you know, I was just...
You were torn.
Absolutely torn.
So Marianne was a Christian friend whom you met here.
Yes, who we found incredibly annoying when she spoke about her faith. When she used to talk about it all...
Sorry, you keep pointing. Is she over here somewhere?
She's over here. She's...
Do you realise how annoying you've been?
It was really annoying to hear Marianne say to me, you know, gay marriages came up quite a lot. And I was a BBC journalist, and gay marriages were completely acceptable. Sorry, John. And the other thing was, gay marriages was one which really irritated me. Female bishops, you know, that was just, you know, what are you talking about? We talk about this every single day, and it's just so ancient to say these things. And the other one was, that Jesus was the only way. And I'd challenge her on that. And I said, but people weren't nice. And obviously Marianne was South African. And I'd go,
They weren't nice in South Africa, Marianne. So why are they going to heaven and the nice Hindus or the nice Muslims or the other races are not going? And she'd be very, very calm and very, you know, actually, she was very calm. She'd say, would you like to come to church with me? And I'd go, no. I'd make every excuse in the book not to come to church.
So what eventually led you to, as it were, cross over the line, to make a decision to ask Jesus to become your Lord and Saviour?
Well, I was going through a really difficult time after having Isabella.
Your daughter?
Yes. And sorry, I get
did
really
you, did
emotional.
Did you just go to a hospital and think you quite like the look of her? And...
That would have been so much easier.
Much less fun, but we'll leave that.
So I think she was 9 months old, and I remember, you know, the relationship with my husband became a bit more turbulent because I wasn't getting enough sleep, and I turn into a monster when I don't sleep. So I was really agitated all the time, and it just became really difficult. And I remember, you know, arguing constantly with him, and we weren't sitting on the same page. I would want to sleep with Isabella, which was a part of an Indian custom, and he was like, what are you doing? And I'm like, she's sleeping on my chest. What do you think I'm doing? And I don't want to do this cot thing. I said, it's so cold to put a baby in the other room. So, you know, my priorities were so different. Culturally, we were on two separate pages. And at 9 months old, I'd said, you know, God, I just had enough of this. This is just not working. I give up. I just spoke to God randomly. And I've had enough. I give up. I'm going back home to South Africa. And I was crying, and I'd gone downstairs, and someone had given me a book by Joyce Meyer at the time. And I'd just gone to Joyce Meyer's book, and I'd opened up to the date, i.e. the 5th of June or the 6th of June. And it just said, don't give up. And that was the exact words that I was saying upstairs. I said, you know, give up, don't give up. I was like, okay, so this is another way of God speaking to me. And I'd asked a friend of ours who was a committed Christian, who you know, Gillian Gautry. I said to her, you know, how do you come to Jesus? Because she was, you know, she was lovely and she'd pray and I'd get moved by her prayer. How do you, and she said, just ask God, Connie, ask God to come into your life. And I was ready then, because I think when you're feeling at your lowest point, there's nowhere else to turn. And I did. I said, God, whoever you are. And I remember crying when I said, whoever you are.
So you had you not clearly understood yet, do you think?
No,
about,
I didn't.
No,
I didn't.
But you just cried out to God for help.
That's,
and,
yeah.
And how was that answered?
And then things started happening after that, because I had started another study with Jehovah's Witnesses, and they were very thrilled, and Marianne had known, and she said, oh, Connie, are you sure you're doing the right thing? And by the way, there's a Christianity Explored course which I'd never heard of before, at St. Mary's, and I said, and she said, you know, St. Mary's has a lot of South Africans there, and I said, what color? And she said, white South Africans. I said, oh, probably friendlier than British people. So I did. I sort of vaguely said I was interested. And then Will had come over. And I
That's
think
the vicar.
This is the St. Mary's vicar. And he had come over. And this is the striking thing. Will had come over on his bicycle. And I didn't experience vicars, you know, on bicycles and so committed before. So something about that struck me as well. Mm. And I'd said I'd do it. And I was like, okay. So, and I prayed about it. I said, there's Jehovah's Witnesses saying, this is the way. And if you don't follow us, you're doomed. And this is the Anglican way. And I didn't know anything, what Anglican meant or anything. And it was halfway through the course that I started trembling.
So Christianity Explored is digging into the Gospel of Mark, isn't it? It's looking
yes.
at the Gospel of Mark and seeing who Jesus is and what he's done and how that affects us. So halfway through the course, what did you understand?
I started trembling. I was really trembling. I got it. I just the penny dropped. I suddenly, the fact that he was there, and this is when I get really emotional. Sorry. So I've asked for loads of tissues and they're here.
There's a pile
oh,
here.
Oh, good. Sam heard me. I said, the fact that he died for me, you know, sometimes when you ask God and God knows that you're ready, and that's when he reveals himself to you. It happened then. It was amazing.
And how long ago was that?
That was in 2011. And I remember one of the people in the group saying, what's it like, Connie? What's it like to know Christ? And I said, is it like chocolate? I said, it's better than chocolate.
And is that good?
Absolutely. I don't need chocolate as much as I used to.
So you came to that moment where you understood that Jesus had died for you, yes. He'd risen from the dead, and now you are sort of trusting in what he'd done for you.
Yes, and it's interesting how at that point you understand that you're still not sure. You're worried, you think you're pretending. This is the other thing. I thought I was pretending to like Jesus, even though I'd got it. Mm. I thought, maybe I'm just pretending. But then it's incredible how the more you read and the more you read the Bible, your appetite becomes insatiable, and you just grow in your faith. And I'm now an unashamed Christian, even at the BBC.
Well, I want to explore that a little bit. But just before we come on to the BBC, how did you, as it were, shake off the Jehovah's Witnesses? Because really, it's a very different religion. They say it's Christian, but it is very, very different.
Absolutely. I didn't have to. That wasn't hard. They shook me off, because when they knew I was beginning a Bible study, and they sort of tried to come in and say that it's satanic and it's, you know, the Trinity is still... And I remember challenging Will and Becca, who had come over for supper once, saying something about, you know, what about this Trinity thing? How do you explain that? And Becca, Will's wife, said to me, you'll understand that later on, in, you know, when you'll come to that. And I thought, that's a cop-out, really, in my head. Sorry, Becca, I've never said this to you.
I can perhaps tell you why everybody's so cold to you.
Because I'm horrible.
No, go on, yes.
And the Trinity wasn't explained still, but this is the thing. It was, you know, you don't get everything in the beginning. Mm. You just understand that Jesus died for you, and that's incredible. And maybe that should be enough. Mm. And in a way it is. And then you understand that you're a sinner. And that was so... It was so freeing to understand that I was a sinner, because I knew. I used to say when I was little, oh, I'm not a sinner. I can also sit on the right-hand side of God.
Oh, really?
Because I'm not a sinner. And then I realized I was. Mm. And it was lovely to know that I was, and God loved you irrespective of that sin. And then I understood the South African context a little bit more.
Mm. So the BBC, not exactly known as the most... Christianity-friendly organization.
No,
they're incredibly cynical, aren't they, and undermining of Christian things. How do you get on there?
It's a struggle, but it's the BBC, this ginormous organization, the most reputable organization in the world. Wonderful to be working for them. And Jesus. So it's hard not to feel, you know, you're on the right side. Because I don't mind saying to people, and it happens quite regularly, where we have a Muslim colleague on our team, and she wears a hijab, and she's far more accepted than I am on the team. Her religion is accepted much better than mine is. Mine is a bit too radical.
And yet you sort of think of the BBC, they love the liberal elite, and yet
Absolutely.
Islam is so anti that. Why do you think Islam...
It's more fashionable now.
Right.
It's more fashionable within the BBC to be a Muslim. It's not cool to be Christian. Mm. What the BBC doesn't realise, and where I'm working, it's just off Oxford Street. We've got the All Souls Church right in front of us. And I'm sure God has a plan there.
So. Well, I think it's very ironic that every time you see the BBC news, you see All Souls.
Absolutely.
And it's all beautifully lit up, and apparently the BBC paid for that lighting to be put on there.
Well, there you go.
Yes.
I do believe that things happen for a reason. I don't know whether the entire BBC is going to convert to Christianity, but obviously God's put them there for a reason.
But do you speak up then? Do you say things?
I do. I was very brave when I was baptized. I don't know what happened to me when I was baptized. For those 3 months, I became the best producer. I could present a program and not be afraid. I was so confident. It was like you were charged with something, that God was saying, this is what it's going might taste like. And then after 3 months, it disappears, which is a shame. I am, because I get it, and I have full confidence in Jesus.
Mm.
And again, it's like Jesus against the BBC, Jesus against a colleague who has a big ego. Do you know, it's not a hard decision to make. So,
interesting. What sort of things do you work on? What have you been doing, say, this week?
We've been looking at lots of things. I mean, there's the surname.
The American soldier.
Yes, whether he's a traitor or a hero. Mm. Or we look at Sudan a lot. We look at Syria. We look at international news, really. We look at Miriam Ibrahim, the Sudanese women. Various things, but having, you know, I say this all the time, but over the past 5 years, things are getting, we used to have a quiet period in news. We don't anymore. It's just busy all the time.
So you're on international affairs, are you?
I am. I work on the international programs.
Do you go overseas? Do they send you overseas to report on issues?
I don't report, but I go as a producer. So we've just come back from South Africa with the South African elections. So we do go overseas to discuss various things. And there's a team from our team in the Ukraine at the moment.
And you must be meeting all sorts of characters.
Completely. We get to meet, people will pass you by. There's David Cameron or Miliband or the Queen or Camilla. The Queen had come over. So we do. And Anton Deck in front of the building.
Who wowed you most, the Queen or Anton Deck?
Anton Deck. No, I don't know. I wasn't there when the Queen was there. But it's weird how I'm not enamoured by a celebrity.
Why?
I think now more... And this is absolutely genuine. When I was younger, I would, you know, I'd think, I would be, you know. And then coming to the BBC, you get to meet all these people and you can easily take what you call selfies now. But now I kind of think, honestly, the biggest celebrity in my life is Jesus. And outside of that, there's nobody greater than that. So, you know, this person's just an ordinary sinner like I am. And I really, you know... Once in a selfie is more than enough, I think.
And just quickly, are your parents still alive?
My mum is. My dad died when I had gone to Israel in 1996.
And how does she regard you having become a Christian?
It's really interesting. My mum's very open, and she's done a Christianity Explored course here with Will at the church. So she's open when she comes here. She's very open. But when she goes back to South Africa, she's surrounded by Hindu people. And people who are still racist or, you know, Christians, that they constantly go, but, you know, if Christians were nice, then maybe we'll consider Christianity, which was what Gandhi said loosely. He said if Christians behaved, followed the example of Jesus, the whole of India would be Christian. But then we didn't get it, as you said earlier on to me. We are sinners, and we will do that. My mum doesn't get that bit. You know, she's 83. I'm still praying for her. They do get annoyed with me now, like the way I used to get annoyed with people who'd preach the gospel to me. So they're in that position. I did say to my sister, you do know that it's only through Jesus that you can go to God. And she was furious, and she said, but you can't say those things. And I said, but I can. And she said, but what about Dad? I said, but Dad would, you know, God's going to meet Dad on Judgment Day. And she said, but how could you? So I'm upsetting a lot of my family members at the moment, speaking about my faith. But if people didn't upset me, I wouldn't have had the urgency.
No, absolutely. And you do seem a very happy sort of radiant person.
I generally am, unless I've had an early morning shift or I've not slept for a long time.
Let's show our appreciation, shall we? Thank you very much. Stay focused.